Fifth case for argument today is United States against Smith. Ms. Zellner.
May it please the court. Good morning. I'm Kylie Zellner, and I represent Mr. Smith in this appeal. I also represented him at the trial level. This appeal results from a conviction at trial for the unlawful transport of firearms. We are requesting that the court vacate that conviction and remand for a retrial. The sole issue in this case is really whether or not Mr. Smith was denied the opportunity for a fair trial and to present a defense when the district court denied his request for a jury instruction on coercion. A defendant is entitled to an instruction of an affirmative defense, such as coercion, if the defendant's instruction is a correct statement of the law, if the theory of defense is supported by the evidence in the case, if the theory of defense is not part of the charge, and if the failure to include the instruction would deny the defendant a fair trial. In this case...
Well, counsel, how was the proposal a correct statement of the law, given the holding of the United States against Bailey?
I believe that the instruction was a correct statement of the law. I'm sorry, I would admit that I'm not familiar with the holding in Bailey.
Oh, well, see, the Bailey discusses the entire category of justification defenses in federal criminal prosecutions. And it says that one element of every justification defense or every greater good defense is that as soon as the exigency has passed, the person report to law enforcement and end the thing that is otherwise a violation of law. So if your client's argument was that he took the guns from these youngsters to prevent them from shooting somebody on the street, under Bailey, as soon as he did that, he had to report immediately to the police and hand over the guns. That's the holding of Bailey. The instruction doesn't require that as an element, and it's perfectly clear your client didn't do that.
Correct. The situation here was that Mr. Smith had a two-part defense, essentially, in this trial. The first part was that when he initially took possession of the weapons, that's where the coercion started. He then took the weapons to his home and turned the weapons over to his mother, who is not a felon, to turn them over to the police.
Bailey doesn't say turning things over to your mother. Bailey says go to the police. Your client didn't do that.
I'm sorry, I was not familiar with Bailey. I will say that in
the
Seventh Circuit in the
But the basic problem is the defense being offered in this case was not compatible with Bailey. The instruction was not a correct statement of the law as the Supreme Court of the United States understands the law, and generally we tend to follow the Supreme Court.
Well, I believe that the instruction was a correct statement of the law in that it establishes what coercion is. And I would say that in the Seventh Circuit in Kilgore said that there is the option to turn it over to a non-felon adult to turn the weapons over. This was a situation where Mr. Smith was extremely worried and concerned about walking into a police department, being a felon, and turning
the weapons over. Your adversary cites Bailey. I'm surprised you're not acquainted with that case.
I did not see Bailey in the brief.
It's cited in the U.S. brief.
Well, I apologize. I'm not familiar with that case. But it was Mr. Smith's contention that he turned the weapon over to a non-felon adult in order to be rid of the weapons and rid of the possession of the weapons. Essentially, Mr. Smith put on enough foundation to get the defense, however tenuous it was. The district court did not rule that he could not put on the defense because he did not turn them over immediately to a police department. They did rule that he needed to call the police. But that was not an option at the time that the children approached him with the weapon, and that the district court also ruled that it was not coercion if the young children just turned the weapons over to Mr. Smith, which, again, I believe is irrelevant because Mr. Smith had no way to predict how the children would react when he took possession of the weapons. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, counsel. Mr. Jacobs.
Please, the court. I'm Matt Jacobs, and I represent the United States and did represent the United States at trial as well. The district court, based on the facts proffered by Mr. Smith, concluded that there was no evidence initially of any imminent or present immediate danger of death or serious bodily injury. In addition, the district court found that whatever basis Mr. Smith had in obtaining those guns, it didn't justify his continued possession of those guns. For those two reasons, the district court properly precluded the defendant from presenting a coercion defense.
I have a question, which is, to what extent at the trial did Mr. Smith present any argument that his possession was fleeting and somebody else possessed the guns the rest of this 2 or 3 week period, or however long it was?
The defendant didn't present additional evidence along those lines. The playing of the tape, which happened at trial, was materially consistent with the proffer of the evidence by Mr. Smith in his pretrial, in his motion in limine. And actually, the statement itself does not suggest that he turned it over to his mother or a non-felon. In fact, he says he's trying to figure out what to do with the gun. He didn't know what to do. So really, the proffered facts didn't even support the second prong of the, again, not contacting police, but at a minimum turning it over to a non-felon. So, again, the proffer as well as the recorded statement itself played at trial did not support the second prong of that, that he turned it over at least to a non-felon, let alone
right.
any contact.
I mean, I'm just trying to make some sense of this case, because possession normally is a continuing offense, and even if you briefly possessed for these urgent reasons, as Bailey says, the urgency passes pretty quickly, and then you've got to do something. And if a couple of weeks later he's still sitting there thinking about it, there actually isn't any urgency. He's a felon who possesses the guns.
Right. And candidly, Judge, that's what the facts left. I think the district court properly found that that's not coercion. Couldn't explain in the first instance, and definitely couldn't explain the continued possession.
There were three guns, weren't there? Two in one location and one in a drawer.
Correct, Judge. There was a pistol initially found in a bureau, and then the two long guns found in a closet off a second bedroom.
And didn't the defendant make some statement about the gun in the drawer being for personal protection? Or?
In the recorded statement, it's not in the proffer for the motion in limine, but in the recorded statement and then as reported by the questioning police officer, he said he had that gun for his personal protection. Again, Your Honors, if there are no further questions, the government will rely on its written brief and ask the court to affirm Mr. Smith's conviction. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Anything further, Ms. Zellner?
I would just like to address the issue of the evidence that came forward at trial in relation to this. Once the judge denied Mr. Smith's request for the coercion instruction, there was really no reason to put Mr. Smith on the trial at that point if the jury would not be given the coercion instruction.
I don't understand. In order to preserve a claim for appeal, you have to make an evidentiary proffer. Whether you put him on the stand or not, you make a proffer of what he would have testified to.
Correct. And we did that in the motion in limine, essentially. We explained to the court that that would be the basis for some foundation to get this instruction in front of the jury. Mr. Smith did not testify at trial because the court was not going to allow the jury instruction, and essentially he would have gotten on the stand and given a full admission at that point, and the testimony would have done him no good. And that's the reason that he did not testify at trial, and these additional facts could not have been adduced at trial.
But you're saying they were there in the motion in limine?
In the motion in limine, it establishes the foundation for the fact that he felt that he was in danger of a threat of serious bodily injury or in harm, that there was a reasonable fear that the threat would be carried out, and that the failure to include the instruction would deny him a fair
right.
trial.
But you can see my concern is about what happens. I'll even be generous and say, like, from the next day forward. It could be, like, from the next hour forward. And I'm wondering if there's any proffered evidence or anything that would allow someone to think that he wasn't in possession of those firearms, even though it appears that he actually was. But
it was explained to the court when we were deciding this and had a hearing on whether or not the jury instruction would be offered to the jury, that it was basically a two-part defense, that on the day he took possession, there was coercion. And the government said at the hearing that's irrelevant to whether or not he had possession of the weapons the day the search warrant was executed.
Right.
And it was our explanation to the judge that we would be arguing that on the date that that the search warrant was executed, Mr. Smith was not in possession of the weapons because he did not have the intent to exercise direction or control over the weapons.
So and that's somewhere in the record that you said that?
Correct.
Okay.
And both Mr. Smith and his mother, who he said he turned the weapons over, were going to be witnesses in the trial. But once the coercion defense was denied, there was no reason to put those additional witnesses on because the government could argue the on or about portion of the indictment as far as the firearms possession went. If there's nothing further, I have.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Zellner, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case. Our final case.